yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the main topic is going to be Bernie Sanders throws his hat again into the ring for the 2020 presidential nomination. Will he run as a Democrat? Will he run as a independent? Will he continue to run? We have a dozen or more Democrats already have thrown their hat in the ring. Many of them have adopted Bernie's program. So how is Bernie going to differentiate himself? And what will the Democratic Party moneybags do about it? As we know, historically, they have done everything to give Bernie the deep six, which they did in 2016. And they've been opposing him all along. But yet we see a lot of his ideas popping up again. Elizabeth Warren and Ocasio-Cortez and others now throwing their hat in the ring. And centrists throwing their hat in the ring to offset. And maybe the whole strategy is to have so many people run that Bernie is lost in the noise. Well, is Bernie even the answer? That's another question we need to ask ourselves. Certainly we're into the 2020 presidential campaign with both feet now. So I want to talk about that. And I have a special guest here who I'm going to introduce shortly, who can give us some real insights and maybe some alternative suggestions here. But before I introduce him, I do want to say one thing about economic news of the past week. Really important. Well, today we see that the job creation, only 20,000 jobs created last month. Well, certainly, the apologists for the economy and those who say everything is fine are going to argue, well, that's because of the government shutdown and the impact on statistics and so forth. Well, but even given that we had economists predicting 180,000 jobs and only 20,000 appear, whoa, what's going on? I've been predicting all throughout the last half of last year that we're on the verge of a global recession and the U.S. will not be able to escape it. And if you're interested, go back to my December 2018 archived podcast on this network where I laid out predictions about the economy, U.S. and global, many of which are already becoming true. I had given a timeline of recession emerging in the U.S. in the fourth quarter of this year, but raised the possibility it might come earlier as well. It was sort of put off a little bit by the Federal Reserve, the central bank, saying it stopped raising interest rates, and that kind of gave everything a temporary boost. But, the numbers keep rolling in globally. China is slowing down faster than people think. A study came out and said its official 6.6% GDP number is really 2% percentage points too high. It's really like 4.5%. And its exports are plummeting, which means the economy is slowing quite rapidly in China. In the U.S., of course, we have, as I've been pointing out, the auto industry pretty much dead in the water. Construction continuing to fall all throughout last year and continuing here, both commercial and residential. Business investment, equipment pretty much gone flat in a year in which Trump gave them trillions of dollars of tax cuts, which pretty much debunks this myth that business tax cuts create jobs. As I've been saying, the tax cuts go into financial markets, they go offshore, they go into mergers and acquisition activity, or they're given back in dividends and buybacks, stock buybacks, now about $1.4 trillion last year, or they're hoarded, and it's not going into real investment. Okay, maybe that's why now with a lag, we're not seeing job creation, and we're going to see a lot less here in this first quarter. I think that the 2.6% U.S. GDP of last quarter is going to halve at least in this first quarter. And at the same time now, Europe news this past week, Europe is falling fast. The central bank there, European Central Bank, adjusted its forecast from a 1.7% GDP to a 1.1%. In other words, almost halved its forecast. European bank problems are beginning to pop up all over the continent. So Europe is in a downturn now, very clearly. China is slowing down. The U.S. shows signs of slowing down. Here it comes, folks. Here it comes, and you can expect another third leg of the stock market contraction occurring sometime this year, probably in the summer. Okay, so that's just my my scenario here, and I would encourage people to listen to the podcast of last December, where I talked about the U.S. economy and where it was going in 2019 and the global economy. Now, let's turn towards what's the solution to all this, because it really looks like we're slipping into the next recession here. And now I want to introduce my guest here, Nick Brana. Nick, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. Jack, thanks for having me again.
Okay, Nick. Now, Nick is a former founder and national director of the Movement for a People's Party, which grew out of the Draft Bernie 2016 campaign, when Bernie got shit on pretty thoroughly by the Democratic Party, and efforts to reform the Democratic Party after the election pretty much collapsed. A new movement, Our Revolution, emerged based on those folks that had been supporting Bernie. Nick Brana here, our guest, had become one of the founders of this post-2016 Our Revolution effort here, was the first electoral manager for the Our Revolution effort, having previously been national political outreach coordinator for Bernie during his 2016 campaign, and prior involvements before all that in various campaigns for different Democratic Party governors and so forth. And now Nick is involved here with this new effort to establish a new third party here called the Labor Community Campaign for Independent Political Party, or LCCIP, which I understand just met this past month in Washington, D.C., and formed an organizing committee. We're going to want to get to that and find out more about that from Nick. But first, I want Nick, who's been in the trenches here with the Democratic Party and alternatives in Washington for some time, to enlighten us as to what may be going on here in the Democratic Party and with Bernie, who just announced. How is the current situation different than 2016? Well, one way it's different, clearly, is that you got a dozen or so Democrats having thrown their hat in the ring, some of them I never heard about, but they all think that they can become president here. And I don't know whether this is all just ambition on the part of the 12, well, some of them we know, Elizabeth Warren and so forth, or whether this is this is conspiratorial, but I'm a little suspicious that maybe the Democratic Party leadership is encouraging all this to get a lot of people in there to muddy the water and confuse the program and the message of Bernie as he runs again. They've adopted a lot of his ideas, and they're running on them, not just Elizabeth, but the others as well, like Green New Deal, 70% tax on the wealthy, free college tuition at public universities, Medicare for all. You know, these are all Bernie ideas, and now they're all adopting them. What is Bernie going to stand for? Are they really outflanking him again? I don't know. Anyway, that's my conspiratorial suspicion here. But let's get to Nick. Nick, maybe that's off the wall, yeah. But I just don't trust those money bags in the Democratic Party. They're capable of anything.
Your instincts are correct, Jack. In 2016, the Democratic Party was caught somewhat off guard by Bernie Sanders and progressives and that kind of insurgency inside the Democratic Party, the progressive insurgency. And this year in 2020, they've spent the past 3 years preparing, in fact, to block him or a progressive successor to him. So they have written the rules to make it much more difficult, virtually impossible, for progressives to get the nomination inside the Democratic Party. And what you mentioned with all of these other candidates being in the race is that's one of the aspects. There's a number of other ones. For example, I'm sure everybody remembers the joint fundraising agreements from 2016, which Hillary Clinton used to basically purchase the DNC and turn the DNC and the Democratic Party apparatus into a wing of her campaign, as Donna Brazile admitted later in 2017. The agreement turned over the entire party's strategy, hiring, spending, messaging, all of that over to the Clinton campaign. And that arrangement is still permissible in the Democratic Party. When it wrote the rules, it got together in Chicago in August of 2018 to write the rules for the next Democratic primary in 2020. And in fact, they kept that. And they did a number of other things. For example, they added a loyalty pledge that says you have to have been faithful to the party throughout your career. Otherwise, the party could deny you access to the ballot. And they also slashed the number of caucuses over primaries, which is a very significant change because Bernie in 2016 won 13 out of 23 contests. 13 out of the 23 states that Bernie won were caucus states because caucuses they favor progressive candidates with really passionate supporters who are willing to go out for a day and really, make the case as opposed to in a primary where you just, go cast the ballot and it might take 15 minutes. So they have slashed the number of caucuses so as to disadvantage Bernie and progressive candidates again. And given that he won more than half of his contests in caucuses, that's going to be a very, very significant and severe change against progressives. And as I'm sure you know, Jack, they have stuck with the basic fundamental trick of robbing progressives in the Democratic Party as well by literally denying millions of independents access to the ballot inside the Democratic Party. And the number of independents in the U.S. continues to grow. It far outnumbers the number of Democrats and Republicans now. And they tend to lean progressive and anti-establishment as well. That's why they're independent. They've left the two parties. And so the Democratic Party is, again, with closed primaries, blocking millions of them from participating in its process to advantage the establishment candidates again. And then it simultaneously sets the deadline to register as a Democrat. If someone, an independent, says, all right, well, I'd like to register as a Democrat so I can cast my vote for Bernie, then the party says, oh, well, the registration deadlines are months in advance. The party switch affiliation deadlines are months in advance of the actual primary when most people aren't paying attention and they have no, they're not aware of that change. So it's done a number of different things to ensure that it can block Bernie Sanders again. And I think that the bottom line is that there is no such thing, and this is a lesson that Bernie taught us, There is no such thing as a people's party, party that represents working people, that is financed by Wall Street and the oligarchs. In fact, these big corporations, they put billions of dollars into every election in the Democratic and Republican parties. That's not charity. That's an investment. And they wouldn't be doing that if they do that specifically for the purpose of maintaining the status quo, so that these parties maintain the status quo. That is the quid pro quo. We're going to give you billions of dollars of corporate Wall Street money. You're going to maintain the system for us, the system which is enriching us at orders of magnitude beyond what they contribute politically. And so I think that's the bottom line, is that, as I'm sure we'll talk about more later, we need a party that is responsible to working people, and that means it has to be entirely free of corporate influence and corporate money, and that's what we're working on.
You said something about these rule changes here. You said a number of things just 6 months ago, I guess, in August 2018, where the Democratic Party changed some rules to make it more difficult for progressives and challengers to pull off a political coup the way Trump pulled off the coup in the Republican Party. Well, not the same way, but that's clearly what he did. And he's transformed the Republicans into his party. They're no longer Republicans. I call them Trump-publicans. You mentioned that there's like a loyalty test now. And in other words, even if you get a nomination in the Democratic Party, that someone, maybe the party chairman or someone, can say, oh, you're not loyal enough. We're going to throw you out.
That is correct. Yes.
Who has the authority to dictate that, no, the people's will and the party for the candidate they want is not the will of the leadership, therefore we're going to negate that will? Who is the person, Democratic Party, that has that authority?
The Democratic, the DNC chairman, which is currently Tom Perez, as it just so happens, showed an immense amount of hostility to Bernie Sanders and progressives during the 2016 race. So he's far from an impartial DNC chairman. He said it was revealed in the WikiLeaks emails that he was discussing and strategizing, conspiring on ways to stick a fork in Bernie's campaign, so to sabotage it, and suggesting to Clinton that she create this image, this impression, that Bernie Sanders only had traction with young white males, you know, that Bernie bro stereotype. And he, you know, that he was responsible for that. And so that is the person who now has the sole authority vested by the DNC and the 2020 Democratic primary rules to decide whether Bernie has been sufficiently faithful throughout his life to run as a Democrat.
Oh, I see. Well, that kind of harkens back historically, where the Communist Party in Russia used to say, oh, no, you can't run. We're only the folks we want can run. It seems to me there's some similarities here now growing in the Democratic Party. So tell us, you know, what's your take on all these other candidates jumping into the ring here along with Bernie? And it seems like have they adopted his program, or what's going on here? What's your take?
This is a trick that the Democratic Party plays every time that it's out of power, because the Democratic Party is aware it can read the polls just like the rest of us. 70% of Americans want Medicare for all. You know, about 62% want free public college. There are large majorities that want much higher taxes for corporations and the wealthy. So they're aware of these things. And so whenever they find themselves out of power on the national level, what they do is they pick up these things, and they, you know, kind of pick up the mantle of progressivism and progressive rhetoric, and they speak in this way. And these issues have not been popular just in the last 4 years, or out of the Bernie 2016 campaign, I should say. These issues have been popular in American politics for decades. A single-payer Medicare for All system, for example, you know, a jobs guarantee. you saw this in 2008 with what the Democrats did and what Obama did. In 2008, the Democrats said, yes, we stand for Medicare for all. We're going to cap carbon. We're going to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which gives unions full organizing rights and helps reverse the right to work. We are going to get special interest money out of politics. We're going to end the wars. We are going to stop mass deportations. Well, voters put Democrats and Obama into office with a filibuster-proof majority. They reneged on everything. And so these, you know, this kind of discourse that's happening now in the media about the Democratic Party is going left. It's going, you know, it's turning left, and these candidates are picking up Bernie Sanders' ideas. You really have to delineate between the party's rhetoric and its actions and its history. And there, the trend emerges that you can very clearly see that this is a game the party plays in order to maintain power.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, one of the proposals of some of these candidates, I think it's Elizabeth Warren, about a tax on the wealthy. There was a recent report here that came out this past week by SurveyMonkey, I think it is, that over 70% of Democrats and independents, which are a majority of the electorate, you put them together, are in favor of a 2% tax on those who have a net worth of $50 million or more. I mean, that's kind of mega rich, right? $50 million. Mm-hmm. You know, over 70% are in favor. Even 51% of Republicans are in favor of that. But yet, incredible. You know, if you read between the lines, there's a big pushback by the wealthy in the Democratic Party to kind of debunk that. There's a big, you know, editorial, ideological counteroffensive against Medicare for all, against tax on the wealthy, against the Green New Deal. You know, they're pushing back. Even though you've got over 70% of the people want the tax on the wealthy, which would just be taking back, you know, the excess tax cuts to some extent that have already been passed. As I've been writing, you know, it amounts to over $4 trillion Trump just gave them here last year over the next decade. $4 trillion investors and businesses and the wealthy 1% in tax cuts, you know, which is creating this massive budget deficit we've got now, over $1 trillion a year. Which is leading, watch in another week or so when Trump's budget comes out, they're planning to cut $125 billion out of non-defense discretionary spending. So in other words, all the rest of us are going to pay for those tax cuts. And already, you know, you see the middle class tax hikes beginning to hit here this year. People just aren't getting refunds anymore. Yeah, you know, I mean, this is all part of the game.
One of the ways that one of the tells, you know, because there's always tells if you look closely enough at what the Democratic Party is doing to distinguish between its rhetoric and its actions. One of them happened very recently, and that was there was at the beginning of the 116th Congress this year on January 3rd, one of the first votes that the new Democratic House majority brought up to the floor was a rules change package inside the House that included a balanced budget austerity provision called PAYGO. This is, you know, typically the Republicans you would think are associated with balancing the budget and government austerity. This was the Democrats that put it forward. That rules package was voted for by more than 99% of the Democratic House caucus. There were only three out of a bunch, 230 Democratic members in the House who opposed it. This PAYGO package essentially says that you have to balance all new expenditures at the federal level with new revenue. This is designed to make it impossible, essentially, to pass Medicare for All, a Green New mm-hmm. Deal, to pass a federal jobs guarantee, and the purpose, free public college. So that really gave away the game on their part, because a number of Democrats, including in the House, especially in the House, have been saying, oh, sure, we support Medicare for all. Just don't ask us to define it. You know, we support a Green New Deal. You know, just don't ask us to define that either. But when the rubber hits the road, what they do instead is almost unanimously, Jack, the caucus voted to pass a measure and a rules package that will make it impossible to achieve those things or even bring those things to a vote. And so that really gives it away. And this, it's not a new phenomenon. In 2015, there was a landmark study that really doesn't get enough attention. It was by Princeton and Northwestern University. And it examined, over the course of 20 years, recent 20 years, what impact does the public's preferences have on which bills are passed? To what degree does it correlate? And what they found is shocking. They found that under the Democratic and the Republican parties, that the public has, quote, a near zero, statistically insignificant effect on public policy. That means that you can have a bill that has 100% support from the people, and it won't pass unless it aligns with the interests of elite. You can have a bill that has 0% support in the public, and it won't pass unless it aligns with the interests of elite. As a result of that study, the United States can no longer be classified as a democracy, because by definition, a democracy means self-government. And under the Democratic and Republican parties, we don't have that.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been saying for a long time, we don't have a two-party system. We have two wings of a single-party system, Republicans and Democrats. And what we got going on to fight politically now is an internecine warfare between two wings of the corporate class here as to what policies they should pursue for the next decade. Globally and domestically, there is no two-party system. And I guess, when you're proposing a third party, you're really proposing a second party, a real alternative here.
Yeah.
And I take from what you say that all this talk going on about these new candidates, about supporting Green New Deal, 70% tax on the wealthy, free college tuition, even Medicare for all, that's just campaign rhetoric.
It is. It's very.
And that if any of them get elected, that they will soon be put on the back burner. Very similar to what happened, as you said, in 2008. Barack Obama sounded like a progressive, but as soon as he won, he put all the bankers in charge of his important cabinets and came out with a weak recovery program, mostly tax cuts and grants to the states. Which did not generate much of a recovery, except for the banks and the wealthy folks done by the central bank, zero interest rates and QE. And, that lack of real recovery set the stage for Donald Trump. So, Barack Obama gave us Donald Trump, as far as I'm concerned. And
that's his legacy. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about this new organization here and what happened here last week, this Labor Community Campaign for Independent Party, LCCIP, which I think you are associated with in some way on the organizing committee, and where folks can find out more information about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So given this political climate in this context where we essentially we have a one-party system, like you say, I think that's an accurate way to describe it. You know, when a corporation finances two of its subsidiaries, two corporate subsidiaries, and it owns them essentially, you don't call that an independent relationship. You know, they're both subsidiaries. And in this case, both of the parties, the Democrats and Republicans, are subsidiaries of Wall Street. They get money from the same corporations, they get money from often the same billionaires. So it's an illusion. And the good news is that people are really becoming cognizant of that. There is now a large majority of Americans who want a major new party. It's 57 to 37%. That's incredible. It's also true that, as I mentioned before, the number of independents is at about 45%. So about half the country's independent. And then about 27% of Americans still identify as Democrats and 27% identify as Republicans. That is an enormous sea change that has happened in our political, in the political landscape in the United States. This tremendous shift in consciousness towards an independent identification, which continues to build, and has created the space for a real party for working people at this point. And so what happened last week is a very significant step towards that. And that is that unions, which have traditionally, in the post-war era, backed the Democrats, but there is an increasingly independent wing of the labor movement that says, wait a minute, for the last 70 years, we have been backing the Democrats. We have spent literally billions of dollars propping up the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And in return, we have gotten mass incarceration, inequality that harkens back to medieval times. We have gotten exploding healthcare costs and education costs. We've gotten our own unions have been are being decimated. And they're saying that kind of return on investment of spending billions of dollars to get those policies is something that corporations and corporate bosses would never tolerate. And neither should we as working people and as labor. And so what happened is we got together for the first time with a number of our labor community campaign endorsers. For this fall, we launched a labor community campaign as the Movement for a People's Party, participating with the organizer and 13 other organizations brought together as this coalition for a major new party. We have some incredible endorsers like Cornel West, Oliver Stone, Ed Asner, as well as people at the highest levels of American labor, people who sit on the AFL-CIO Executive Council in the United States. And some of those individuals at the highest levels of American labor, we got together with them. We convened our big labor supporters for the first time as a labor community campaign for an independent party. And we got together to discuss, is the country prepared for a major new party for working people? And if so, how can we do it? How can it be done? And the decision among the 29 people, the conclusion among the 29 people who were there was that, yes, this country is very much prepared for a major new party. And in fact, it is in dire need of one at this point. And so we decided to form an organizing committee of 29 people, which is already expanding to push this work forward. And I should mention that that some of the individuals on this organizing committee, union president, AFL-CIO executive council members, the former president of the South Carolina AFL-CIO, so very high-ranking members in labor who are saying, enough is enough. It's time that we participate in putting together a party for working people.
So what was decided at this meeting as the next immediate step, and what's your longer-term objectives with regard to the 2020 elections?
I'm glad you asked. So part of it has to do actually with your opening comments to the segment. And that is that something that we saw as we kind of tried to look at where the country is now politically is that within about a year, there are going to be massive shocks in this country, politically, economically. One of them is a recession, as you mentioned. We're about 10 years out from a recession. It is, and the indicators are everywhere, as you mentioned, even the IMF and major banks are saying, yes, there's a, you know, there's a global slowdown. Since the Great Recession in 2008, working people have not recovered from that. We now have a country in which 80% of people live paycheck to paycheck, and 70% of people cannot afford a $1,000 emergency or unplanned expense. And so there's literally no more margin of error in the country, economically speaking, in terms of people's safety. This is a, we live in a very precarious country now that, that is kind of walking on a knife edge in terms of people's survival and their livelihood.
When it's been pushed along by force-feeding people more and more debt, you know, mortgage debt and auto debt and the student debt and credit card debt. All that's over $1 trillion and $1.5 trillion, whatever. And no real wage increases. All this talk about, we got moderate wage increases. I've written and talked about it, which is just a misrepresentation of the fact that most wages, 80%, have not increased in real terms, that the folks at the top have skewed it. So it looks like there's an average gain, and they only talk about full-time workers. They don't talk about the 50 million people who don't have full-time jobs. And all the job creation I've been arguing is also misrepresented, up until now. Now it's showing its ugly head by counting people working two and three jobs as a new job being created. So, the statistics are very suspect since 2008-09, and it's mostly the folks at the top who live off of capital incomes and managers and, you know, high-level professionals who have benefited, if at all, over the last 8 years. And I agree, people are really precarious here. The vast majority are precarious, and when there's another downturn that's coming soon, who knows how that's going to turn out. You're absolutely right.
It's going to be very severe. That is one of the shocks that we see coming in the next year. And the other is another rigged Democratic primary, which we were discussing earlier, too. And so these will be two very big shocks. Both of them will be a repetition of something that happened before. And so it's not really, it's not a one-of. It goes to show that the problem is systemic. If these things are happening again, another rigged primary, another devastating economic crash. And so given that, in the face of these crises, there must be, we thought, a genuine progressive, a genuine alternative to the establishment parties, because the absence of that in the United States is creating this rightward shift, and it's empowering the Donald Trumps of the country to come into office. And so that is what we discussed. And in particular, what we're looking to do is two things, and that is to organize amongst unions and in the progressive community, in the labor and progressive movements, to build this movement for a major new party. And the second is to build labor community assemblies in cities and localities across the country where you begin to unite union locals and community organizations together who can run independent municipal candidates at first, to begin at that stage and start building in that way the fabric of a new party in the United States with candidates that are locally run, accountable, and selected.
So how are you going to take 20, 29 members or whatever at this organizing committee and build these local assemblies, which sounds really the right approach? You know, I've been an opponent of intellectuals declaring a party top down and then, nothing happens except they talk to themselves. I think you got the right approach here from the bottom up. But how do you expand from 29 organizing committee members here last week to creating these committees, or assemblies rather? What's your next immediate step, next 90 days?
Well, I should say that the organizations represented that are supporting the labor community campaign for an independent party, such as, for example, the Movement for a People's Party, the organizer, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which is a 26,000 member union of Latino farm workers, and others. So, for example, Teamsters, Local 808 in Long Island City in New York. All of these organizations represent more than 100,000 members. And so the idea is that we will move as organizations to start building those in the areas where we have the most support. And that will give us essentially a foothold politically.
Now, you mentioned you got several participants, you know, with some notoriety and name, Cornel West, Chris Hedges, Oliver Stone. Are they going to get involved and, you know, make some statements, make some appearances where you think you can jumpstart this thing with local assemblies? Are they just put their name to it, or are they going to put some skin in the game?
No, they're serious about it. And so they will be, we're discussing what kind of event we will do with them. For example, possibly a town hall, which is broadcast digitally in the way that Bernie Sanders has been broadcasting some of his town halls to people over social media and the internet, doing one of those as well, where we bring together as many people as we can physically and then broadcast all over social media and the net with these individuals as well, like Cornel West and Oliver Stone. And I should just mention some of the others who are with us. I mean, Abby Martin, Ron Placone, Jimmy Dore, Eleanor Goldfield. So it's there's more than 1,000 people who have signed on individually and who want to participate in organizing this. So we've already made a lot of progress from the organizing that we have since the fall.
Well, where can people listening to this podcast or finding out more about this go to find out how they might be able to participate? What you got a website and some sources where they can, if they want to jump in and try it?
Absolutely. So please come visit us you can find us at socialistorganizer.com, and you can also find us at forapeoplesparty.org. And you can find the information there. We're in the process of building out an infrastructure as the labor community campaign in for itself. And that means a website. That means social media pages. Given this commitment now on the parts of many different organizations and individuals to build this movement.
Tell us about the program you envision for this, because program is everything, you know? I mean, people can run on their notoriety or, you know, get PR and so forth, but what do you really stand for, and how is it different from Sanders' campaign? Because he's still running, right? How is the LCCIP, or, you know, the Labor Committee organizing, whatever, program different from what Sanders is proposing?
That's right. It's a lot of it is similar and intersects with what Bernie Sanders is proposing. I would say that one of the greatest differences, if you're talking about comparisons to Bernie's platform itself, is that we are strongly against war. The military budget in the United States consumes almost 60% of the discretionary budget now. It's at about $700 billion. And in fact, it's at there's a higher ratio of military spending to social spending than there was during the Cold War.
Let me correct you on amount. That. That's just the Pentagon budget and spending, and it doesn't include the offshore contingency the operations, which is direct war spending, and it doesn't include veterans or the cost of energy and oil and so forth. You know, the true and Homeland Security, the true spending, or CIA, NSA, is over $1 trillion. You know, it's not $700 billion. It's over $1 trillion a year.
You're absolutely right. And that dwarfs what essentially every other country in the world spends. It's just more than the next 10 countries combined when you include those things. And so that is one. The basic platform is one that we stand not just for political freedoms, but for economic freedoms. In 1944, Franklin Roosevelt gave an address that was a follow-up on his State of the Union address in 32 or earlier in his presidency. And he said that it has become clear that Americans are not truly free with just political rights, that in fact there is an economic dimension to freedom, and that is you are not free if you cannot afford, if you don't have the comforts of secure health care, if you don't have the comfort of employment, reliable employment and an income, shelter, food. And this was a sentiment echoed decades later by Martin Luther King when he turned in his later years from the struggle for civil rights, and he turned towards a wider struggle for economic rights. And he said, what good is it if African Americans can sit at the lunch counter if they cannot afford the hamburger? And so that is the underlying principle of our program, which includes Medicare for All, free public college, a Green New Deal, a federal jobs guarantee, and many of those items that progressives support today and in fact beyond. Things like public banking across the United States is integral to financing these.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of congruity here with some of what the progressives running on the Democratic ticket have raised, but the big difference is, who will deliver on that if they're getting big checks from the money bags and the corporate elite in this country? It's one thing to talk about it, but it's one thing to deliver on it. What's your position for those who are listening on climate change? A lot of folks are concerned about that now that we've got all these disasters beginning to occur all over. What's your new LCCIP position on climate change?
It's the Green New Deal is an issue that it's a policy that tackles and solves so many different issues at the same time that it's really a mark of our political paralysis and corruption that we cannot pass one. And that is, for example, it tackles the issue of climate change, which Americans are beginning to experience more vividly, such as with the fires in California, more frequent flooding and more powerful storms on the coasts. And at the same time as tackling the issue of being a jobs program, being a 21st century version of public works, in creating the infrastructure for a new renewable energy future in the United States. So putting millions of people to work in good paying jobs. At the same time, also being able to build affordable housing in the United States. So the Green New Deal is a fantastic way that we support to address those issues. It goes back to what you said, and that is that it is not possible to pass or approve any of these things as long as you're working within the framework of a corporate party. That is ultimately what is dominant. Nancy Pelosi, for example, has been signaling to lobbyists. She says, oh, yeah, we're talking about Medicare for All publicly, but wink, wink, don't worry about it. In the end, it's all just a charade. And in truth, that's what it is. It takes a non-corporate funded party to really make good on any of these promises. Something that is owned by working people. And part of the challenge of doing that, Jack, is you have to not just create a major new party, you have to redefine what a political party is in the U.S. The reason that the Democratic and Republican parties are so controlled by Wall Street is how incredibly controlled and centralized they are as internal institutions. For example, their members, they don't even really have members. It's kind of a misnomer to say that because the members have no authority and no recognition. They're not recognized by the party. But the voters say they don't have the ability to elect the leadership. They don't have the ability to recall the leadership. They don't have the ability to pass a platform that is meaningful. For example, in 2016, the Bernie delegates fought for a platform that was more progressive than the Democratic Party had passed before. The Hillary delegates far outnumbered them, and so it didn't go nearly far enough. But what the party did the next year was very instrumental, and that is it took the platform passed by the delegates and it threw it out. And it replaced it with an entirely different platform called the Better Deal, which was more conservative. And so it goes to show there's just no accountability in this party.
Yeah, well, as you said, they don't want real dues-paying members, because if they paid dues, then they would insist on having a voice. So it's just come vote for us party. You know, and it's the dues payers are the corporate campaign contributors, you know, and they pay big dues, right, and they get big returns for that. You know, your new organization here, is this going to be a membership dues paying kind of an organization? Do you envision it in that sense?
Yes, absolutely. Because it needs to be that. It needs to be rooted in the membership so that it doesn't become disconnected. You know, none of us want to recreate the Democratic or Republican parties. And so, in fact, in our announcing statement, which went out yesterday, we talked specifically about that part of our mission as the Labor Community Campaign for an Independent Party is going to be to identify a dues-based model for the party and for the labor community assemblies, which are going to be growing in communities across the country. And so that is essential in order to maintain an organization's independence, as we've seen. And that's the union model, in fact. That is the union model that is so powerful. And so there is no reason to stray from that. There's every reason to use it.
Right. If you're a union member and you pay dues, you have a voice at meetings and voting and so forth. You know, it's like one person, one vote. And that's the way it should be to ensure accountability from below. It's not perfect. Right. You know, sometimes leaders find a way of getting around that. But without that, there's no real say in accountability. I hope, once you get, your structure going a little bit, these local assemblies and, the dues paying membership idea, that you can come back on and tell people where they can go to become a member, card carrying member, we can call it. You know, we used to say card carrying union member. And join and pay some dues and go to a local assembly meeting and influence the direction and policy. I think that's really, really critical. And I hope you guys can get that going soon. And once you do, let me know. And, you know, we'll have you back on and telling us more about what's coming next. With the effort and the organizing, because we're running out of time here, 2020. It's not even guaranteed, in my view, that Trump won't re-win election. A lot depends. Everything depends, in my belief, on what happens to the economy before 2020, because I don't think the Democrats have the right strategy to even win in 2020 right now. So we will, I hope you can come back on. Consider that an invitation, Nick, to come back on and tell us once things have really gotten going here. With your organization, and we'll be looking forward to where people can go to find out more of what's going on. You gave us some websites, but it sounds like they're the websites of some of the groups supporting it rather than the LCCIP itself. And I like the idea that you raised about using social media to organize people. I think that's an essential in the 21st century. Yeah. And hopefully you can get a real strategy going there as well.
If I could point out one more thing, Jack, that is that there is a wave happening. There is essentially a global rebellion happening now against neoliberalism. And parties, long established parties that have ruled in particular countries, say France, Italy, Greece, Spain, Chile, Brazil, Mexico, in all of these countries and more, long established political parties that have controlled the political system for decades, sometimes in Mexico's case a century, the same party, are now all in the last 4 and 5 years collapsing in the face of new progressive and left parties. And so there is really something going on, and that is what we're looking to bring to the United States. And to get to your point about social media, that is that they are being organized and propelled largely on the basis of social media. And so that's very important because it has given, what the internet has done in general is that it has given working people a way of circumventing the gatekeepers of information, whether it's in the media through peer-to-peer sharing. It's given us a way to create easier dues-based membership models like the one that we have, like the one that Bernie Sanders, for example, is using right now to accept contributions from millions of people. And so the internet has enabled a different politics. And when you combine that new potential with this terrible situation that we find ourselves politically in this country without a legitimate democracy and on the verge of other major national crises, then you really have this incredible opportunity in the United States to change things very significantly with a major new party.
Well, I agree with you. This is a crisis of 21st century global capitalism going on in the collapse of the middle. And when the middle collapses, who's going to fill the vacuum? And if you don't have a progressive alternative, the vacuum will be filled by the right wingers, which we see in many places going on here. Radical right politics stepping in. I really hope we can have a progressive left alternative here, as a solution in the U.S., because if we don't, the right will go even further to the right, and Trump will appear as if he's a progressive himself eventually, the way things will go in the next crisis that's coming sooner than people think. Make sure you let us know what the next step is. Go ahead. Another comment?
You're right. The next Trump will be much worse. It can get much worse. Anyone who would like to see that for themselves just has to look at Brazil, where a fascist, Bolsonaro was literally elected there. And so there's an incredible urgency around creating this and being able to offer a genuinely anti-establishment alternative on the left.
Right.
And I would say
the organization question is the central question of today. Thank you, Nick, for coming on, telling us about the LCCIP and where people can go, and have you back on soon. Thank you.